Floors and fittings. This is the house built on flat of scrap white pine and sycamore. Family floored with chisel, chainsaw, hammer. They faced the flat of walls, lime plastered and plugged of breath, by sand and water, too wet to bet the mortgage on. This is the house built on sweat of potsherd women, whole as wood thinnings, and yet they rolled the bones of great, grand, and mother, fashioned tongues as door, with chisel, chainsaw, hammer. They bet the rent on love lack, and lack of love is what their whetstone bent into its fittings. Then straw to broom they jumped from heart to floor. This is the house built with muddied good intentions, dried to vowel-stopped breath, and yet, and yet, and yet, they bet, with chisel, chainsaw, hammer. So send a postcard just to the west of I do and yes, and there will be the house built with chisel, chainsaw, and hammer.
So I'm talking here today with Denise Miller and Michelle Johnson. Denise, I'll start with you first because we're talking also about Core, a full-length poetry collection that you just had come out with Willow Books. So you're an instructor, an artist, a poet, a community activist, a chef. Is poetry another form of your activism?
Absolutely. I think that I started writing poetry when I was fairly young. Actually, my first art was visual art, but then I started writing poetry as well. And it's been a way for me to, I kind of call it my medicine. Mm-hmm. It's been a way for me to transform what things I take in, what things I feel like people in the world are taking in, and kind of take that in, transform it, I hope. That sounds pretty lofty, but I hope. And then put it back out there in ways that hopefully it helps to shift individuals, my own internal self, and in some cases, I hope communities. Well, in every case, I hope communities. And that's kind of the purpose of what I do.
And the community probably knows both of you well as co-founders of Fire. Mm-hmm. But at one point, you went, you had a vegetarian and vegan restaurant mm-hmm. called Fuel here. But then you went to Chicago for a while. And I understand that's where the book started taking shape. Tell us about that journey.
Well, it was a really interesting journey. One of the things that happened in terms of my activism, another piece of that is food activism and accessibility. And that kind of started really with Michelle exposing me to being vegetarian and alternative ways of eating as social justice, not just about health, but about the equality of all living beings. And so that was really important. And so as a component of that work, we started Fuel as a vegetarian, vegan, and raw food restaurant. And it was a really wonderful experience. So wonderful, in fact, that I got offered a restaurant in Chicago with the same sort of social justice bent. I decided initially to try to do both here, and I continued to teach and do Chicago. And ultimately, what happened when I decided to go there is I turned down the deal. It wasn't the best fit for me and my own sense of grassroots community work. And so what I decided to do, though, was stay there. I had a wonderful place a block off the lake, and I've been realizing that teaching and food and nonprofit work wasn't allowing me to finish my own art. And one of the things that we did when we started Fire was we wanted a place where people could live their authentic selves and mm-hmm. be sustained by that, and realized I wasn't completely doing that. So I stayed and decided to finish this manuscript that I'd been working since my sabbatical in 2006. So finally finished the manuscript. There are other things that happened in between that kept me from that as well. I had an illness that I had to work through, a physical illness that I had to work through. And getting through all of that, getting through and finally getting to this place, I felt like it was the universe saying, you know, time for you to do what you need to do. So I did, and I finished it, and I sent it out, and did a lot of art at that time as well, and got some gallery exposure as well, and just some really wonderful things. The book got accepted through a really great press with some of my favorite authors. Randall Horton's my editor, which is a dream come true.
And the cover is yours.
The cover is mine. It's a piece of my visual art. Heather Buchanan was really wonderful and saw the piece and said, yes, it can be your cover. And I was so thankful for that. And, you know, there's some great people on the press. E. Ethelbert Miller's on the press. Just a dream come true. So the book is finished and it's out there, and I'm excited.
And you've got this interesting collaboration in there, mm-hmm. in this collection with Michelle. And Michelle, if you can tell us, you were somewhere during that same time, I believe, working on some oral histories, a project called Community Spaces. Tell us about that.
Oh, well, the Community Spaces project, the Community Spaces of the Industrious, which is based in Saginaw, actually was birthed when I returned back from the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee after my first job in the English department there, and was really prompted to continue what I'd done with my dissertation. I had a very strong emphasis on adding the voices of the folks that were continuing to live, talking about their relationship with the natural world. These were Black folks. But also, and during my dissertation, I drew very heavily from the WPA narratives, the voices of people who had been formerly enslaved, collected in the 1930s. So I've been involved in incorporating voices of folks that are oftentimes marginalized when we tell stories for a really long time. And in my various collaborations with Denise, I revealed to her this 300, 400 page document of Latinos and Black folks in Saginaw, pretty much up to the 1990s, but starting especially in the 1930s. So talking with folks that had worked in the automobile plants there in Saginaw, malleable gray iron, et cetera. And so that and other projects that Denise and I had done, particularly around bringing the voices of people who were enslaved to a project called Each of These Legs is the Road, as I served as the Freedom Trail coordinator for the state of Michigan, we kind of excavated some of these first-person narratives of resistance and escape, and then Denise did persona poetry in connection with them with lovely music, some original, some covers by Lindsay Kelly. So we'd been doing these kind of combinations of projects in ways and drew very heavily from both of our roots. And so that's where this particular project came into play, is kind of the culmination, at least at that point, of kind of poetry and oral testimony in both of our trajectories.
And Denise, then how did you combine this?
The whole process of me doing persona poetry probably started maybe in 2002.
And why don't you explain, just in case
Absolutely.
People don't know, what is persona poetry?
Poetry in the voices of other people. So one of my favorite poets that I ran across a long time ago that was an inspiration for me was AI. She since passed away, but really wonderful books. And she started tackling some stories, very difficult stories of famous people, infamous, really, right? Mm. Her books are called Sin, Envy, Greed, you know. And so she really tackled some hard subjects. And so when I first started to try to figure out really how to tackle my own growing up and the stories, I mean, we all sort of have to make sense of our families and relationships. And when we're kids, we wonder about the choices grown folks make. And when we're grown folks, we wonder about the choices we make. And so this was a process of me kind of figuring out those stories. And so when the grown-ups would talk to me, I would start to sort of think, okay, how can I translate this as an adult into how can relationships work for me? What do I take from what I grew up with and what do I leave behind? And so this was a part of that process. So I started writing poems about my great-grandmother, who was one of the people that raised me, and taking slips of stories that she told me and really wanting to retell them in her voice, because I think people need to know who she is. And then my father, who's a really wonderful, amazing man, who's very much still with us, who is a coal miner. I also wanted to tell some of the stories that he was telling me about growing up in rural Ohio, which is where I grew up. And Michelle actually did an oral interview with him as well. So he gave his oral testimony, and some of those poems are in the book. And so it's all started there. And then the first story was my great-grandmother saying that the man that she was married to, he wanted to go to New York, and she told him to leave, go on, I'm going to stay here. And I thought that was amazing for a woman to be that strong and to be able to do that in the early 1900s. And so then when Michelle showed me what she was doing with the oral testimonies, those 300 pages of work, I dug in and I was moved. One, about the amazing way that she gets people to tell story and to open up to who they are and to share that. So I really loved reading her conversations. And so I wanted to include those in the book. So those are the found poems. And reading that and then reading their stories, I couldn't not retell them. I couldn't not. I feel like it's like an artist who sees something really amazing, and then needs to repaint it, needs to give it another sort of opportunity for people to be exposed to it. I couldn't not do it. These stories are too valuable and too moving. And I'm just hoping that by doing them through poetry, that people that wouldn't necessarily pick up the oral testimonies would want to access them because of the poems, and then go back mm-hmm. and read more. I keep hoping that she'll publish the collection. I do, and her mom does as well, I know.
So where do you go from here? The years that I've known the both of you, you both impress me as incredibly energetic, passionate, intense women who always have 1,000 things going on. What's going on these days?
Well, I'm currently the community historian for the state of the Michigan, or a community historian, working on a project called Exhibits for a New Century. It's a Kellogg-funded project that is a 3-year project looking at how to revise what we have currently at the State of Michigan Museum, a museum on pre-1915 Michigan history that was put together in the 70s. And so we've changed a lot in terms of what we understand and the kind of information that we can be able to incorporate it and how we tell stories on a public level like that. So I've been charged with now for just a little over a year collecting stories and histories of pre-1915 black communities across the state of Michigan. So I'm in Saginaw, Detroit, Battle Creek, Marshall, Niles, Benton Harbor, Houghton, Grand Haven, Grand Rapids, and expanding into Flint, Bay City, and Albion as soon as I can get as soon as I can get a handle on these probably 11,000 pages of pension records, Civil War pension records for black soldiers that we've just collected the National Archives just about a month ago. Yeah. Oh, my goodness. It's, again, coming. It keeps coming back to this question of people being able to tell their stories. Now, in these records, I mean, and this is just only one of the vast number of documents that we're drawing from, but in these documents, it's a problematic relationship because folks are coming forward trying to gain the pension that they very well deserve, a pittance of a pension in many cases, but they have to provide testimony for themselves, have up to 10, sometimes 12 people come in to provide affidavits to prove that they were in the Civil War, that they're really sick. And in the cases of women, these are really fascinating. The widow's pensions have to prove that they have maintained their virtuousness since the death of their husband. And there was actually an act in 1882, August 7th of 1882, that said if a woman had engaged in any kind of illicit affairs or any kinds of cohabitation with the men, even after her husband was dead, she could no longer get her pension. And so these pension records are filled with so much information. And again, these very firsthand, coerced in some cases, testimonies, as people frequently are, as they're supposed to be gaining access to American liberties. But yeah, so that's what I'm very much involved with, research, amazing research teams across the state of Michigan. You know, the folks in Niles and Detroit and Battle Creek and Kalamazoo are just really amazing. So I'm on the road a lot. I think, over 40,000 miles on my car in just the last little over a year. But it's incredible work, not because just people are deep into reinvigorating the past, but these are folks with very strong roots in activism, in social justice, in historical recovery for their lifetimes. And I'm talking to folks who are in their 80s and their 90s. And they have very clear visions for what our present and our future can be like. So for me, history is that piece of being out in the public, being out in the field, being very Zora Neale Hurston inspired is, as Denise said, a dream come true. This is a dream come true. I've had a lot of really great jobs, but this is the up there in the top, in the top echelon of them.
Oh, I can imagine. That's fascinating. And Denise, what's your follow-up act?
A pittance of a pension. That sounds like a poem in the making.
There you go.
So definitely, it was wonderful to be doing research, to research these pension records and to take pictures of them and to dig into those. And so definitely, I want to do a similar thing as what I've been doing, which is retelling some of those stories and poems. So that's very much a project at the forefront. I have a whole list of projects, honestly. There are other projects.
I'm not surprised.
Another project that I want to do, and I'm working on currently, is recovering the stories of African American towns that have disappeared. Near where I'm from, there's a town of formerly enslaved people and free people of color, and that's very, very rare. From where I'm from, at least I thought it was. And so in part, I'm wanting to recover those stories. I feel like part archaeologist, part historian, part poet, and part human being, really trying to reach back and make connections between the past and the present for my own self and for a larger community. There's another project that I'm working on that I'm kind of working on a little undercover, but it's poetry. It's going to deal with mapping. It's going to deal with travel. And then there's also another project that I'm working on called Controlling the Narrative. It's a Michigan Humanities Council grant, and the concept of the grant really came from what's happening in terms of, you know, African Americans and people of color and violence against them in this country. And so very much following the idea that if we get an opportunity to tell our own stories in our own voices before people have an opportunity to rewrite us as something different, then it might save lives. And so, you know, the project is a visual art project. I've done some exhibits around the state. And it's also a very academic project in terms of getting people together for conversations and workshops. I do a lot of diversity workshops, a lot of diversity training around intersectionality and different identities. And then also from that, we're going to do a few plays, three-act play that's going to kind of pop around the community, poems, and some sort of anthology. So we're just sort of letting that take shape. And so it was very much rooted in one of my favorite writers, James Baldwin, and his idea of identity. And he's just always moved me in terms of his work, especially The Fire Next Time. It's a seminal piece of work. And so just really trying to rewrite these narratives. And it's a big project. Part of my going to get these pension records is looking at a number of tiers of ancestors. One of them are African Americans who settled here in Michigan during the Civil War and after, and then coupling that with what I call our current ancestors. Unfortunately, the 3-year-old and the 7-year-old that were killed in Detroit when the police officers were chasing some suspects, and Tamir Rice and Sandra Bland, I mean, our current ancestors. And then those of us that are here now, walking and living in this identity of being African American in this country and what that means. And then also what that means for other people who are living, all of us who are living in a larger society that really has been rooted for so long in violence. And so, and there are a couple of other projects, but probably don't have, and I'm working on all of them simultaneously because I write what moves.
You're both amazing.
So,
and maybe one of the Great Writers Project one of those other projects that we're working on. It's kind of a closing project with Fire Historical and Cultural Arts Collaborative that we're working with, as well as Kalamazoo Public Schools. Mm-hmm. And that is really an attempt to respond to young people's request for especially more Black and Latino voices in their school system. Mm-hmm. And so we've put together a curriculum that really great teachers at Loy Norix and Millwood are working with their students on, and then working with folks, a broad generation of folks, to really bring the stories and the activism that comes through in works like Audre Lorde and James Baldwin and Zora Neale Hurston and Martin Luther King and Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta. So having those voices be a significant part of what our young people are asking for, and then they will be doing some significant writing as well. So another project that we are partnering on.
And that, yeah, telling our own stories and really getting those out there.
So speaking of partnering, I understand you've got some of these poems in core.
Absolutely.
Where both of you can read.
Yes. So the concept of core is to tell stories of blue-collar workers, coal miners, iron foundry workers, and to tell those stories, and then to also, the poems are typically in trios, so first person speaks. Usually these are about what blue-collar work does to families. So first person speaks in one poem, and then there's a line that goes into the next poem that another person gets to respond. So maybe it's a husband and wife, or a boyfriend and a girlfriend, or a child and an adult. And then after that, there's a third poem that they come together in. But what we're going to read today is we're going to read the first. Michelle's going to read one of the interviews and found poem form, so it's a little odd. We'll want to read it together. Okay, so the italics, if you get the book, when you get the book, the italics is Michelle, and then her interview and pieces of that. And then I'll read the non-italicized parts, which is the person that she was interviewing. And then I'll read a poem after that called Purpose that hopefully you'll see how I came to that poem. And that poem is in the voice of the person interviewed. And so if you could say the interview, you want to say, yeah.
Interview with John Pfeiffer, August 4th, 1999.
And the poem is called How Long? Work was, oh God, work was hard at the malleable.
What were you doing out there?
Duberman.
What's that?
That's the hardest. That's lifting molds. I mean, 60, 70.
How long? Lift them up off the belt? How long?
Lift it from the mold machine to the belt, about 8 hours or 9, 10, whatever. They working, you do.
Was hot, wasn't it?
Hot, hot, hot. I mean, red hot. That's why I say you have to have a purpose or family or something in order to stay. You had to know what work were, something you know. You couldn't just go in there and I got a job. You had to have something to think about that makes you do this for 8 or 9 or 10 hours. But soon, as you go home, hands swole, take some Epsom salt, mama, and alcohol, and rub them down.
How long, so would you lift them?
Till I get ready to retire. And so that's kind of, you'll notice it's broken up because found poem form. I wanted this to not just read like the interview visually, but I wanted to kind of pull out these parts. And so when you see it, the spaces between are breaking up the line or the sentences. And in some cases, the spaces between, I didn't leave out any words. I just kind of left space. So I didn't want to change it. I just wanted to pull out or highlight. So here's the poem that grew from that. Purpose. You had to have something to think about, made you able to be Duberman or shakeout at the malleable. 8, 9, 10 hours of cracking cast from sand or pouring 3,000 tons of melted metal a day while sweat swilled slick into iron and flicked like fireworks on concrete. There was no freedom in this. Black men going in, skin all shades of Saginaw soil, then coming out darker than the coal that heated the foundry. See, I had to find me a purpose, something to keep me shifting mold to belt, so that every second felt light as lifting bread to my daughter's mouth with my fingertips.